This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It's our children who will be the first generation who will be eating these foods for their entire lives. So this is an experiment on them. That's why this is so troubling to so many people, to so many Americans. We don't know the health risks. We don't know what health problems may come up, in part because there is no labeling.
Have you ever tasted a strawberry whose DNA was altered to include fish genes? Before my interview with today's guest, I would have said that I had not. Now I'd have to say, I really don't know. I know I've never eaten a strawberry whose label indicated that it had been genetically modified. In fact, here in the United States, genetically modified foods are not generally labeled as such. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Charles Margulis, Communications and Food Program Director at the Center for Environmental Health and former lead for Greenpeace's genetic engineering campaign. Margulis believes that American consumers have the right to know when they're eating genetically modified organisms, or as he calls them, unlabeled experimental foods. Listen as we discuss the rise of the GMO, the movement pushing for more regulation of GMOs, and the substantial resistance that proponents of GMO labeling have encountered. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Charles Margulis. He's the communications director for the Center for Environmental Health, which is an organization that works to protect children and families from harmful chemicals and substances in their food, air, and water. Charles, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Your organization has been involved in a GMO labeling campaign. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about your efforts.
Sure. This is a nationwide effort with more than 500 organizations working to get the Food and Drug Administration to require labels on genetically engineered food. These are foods that have been hidden in our diets for a little bit over a decade. Unfortunately, most Americans don't even realize that we're eating genetically engineered foods almost every day. That's why we think these foods should be labeled. People have a right to know what's in their food.
And you're not really calling for a ban on GMOs, correct? This is just a transparency issue.
Right. I mean, these are foods that have been altered in ways with a technology that's never before been used in the food supply. So, for example, we have soybeans engineered with petunia genes. Now, that may sound non-problematic on the face of it, but people haven't eaten petunias before. There's no long-term human history of eating petunias. Many of these genetically engineered crops that are used in our diets today have bacterial genes and viral genes and ways of inserting these genes into our foods that could cause problems. Scientists say could cause problems, health problems, environmental problems, and problems for other farmers. These are all things that consumers want to know about when they go to the store and do their shopping. And unfortunately, we're one of the few countries on the planet that doesn't require labeling of genetically engineered foods.
And the pro-GMO camp has said for many years that GMOs are really nothing new. Genetic modification of our food crops has been done since before the modern era. But these are, as you just mentioned about the petunias, these are a stark departure from traditional methods of animal and plant breeding, right?
Exactly. The industry likes to confuse the notion of breeding crops and animals with genetically engineering them. A scientist I once worked with said, this is like comparing a bicycle to a Formula One race car. Yes, they are both modes of transportation, but that's about where the comparison ends. With traditional breeding, you can't cross unrelated species in ways that don't occur in nature. So, for example, genetic engineers have crossed strawberries with fish genes to create fish berries, strawberries that are engineered to withstand cold temperatures using genes from fish that live in very cold waters.
I think my four-year-old would really like those, actually.
Yeah, so, well, some people love the idea of fish genes in their strawberries, but at the very least, your four-year-old should know that she has that choice to make that dip and not have those engineered strawberries without any labeling. And that's just what we're asking for. We're simply asking for people to label these foods. Obviously, this is completely different than natural breeding. The industry says, well, we've had 10,000 years of safe breeding, and this is just like breeding. Well, you put a fish and a strawberry in a room together, and 10,000 years later, they're not going to breed. That's not going to happen. These unlabeled experimental foods are a widespread experiment on our bodies and our environment. At the very least, we should have labeling so we can know whether or not we want to consent to being part of this experiment.
And some leading technologists like Bill Gates, who's also an important philanthropist, and his organization has done a lot of important work in Africa and other developing areas of the world. He's a noted backer of genetically modified foods, but I couldn't help but think as I read his comments on this. I think he spoke at the World Economic Forum a couple of years ago and was asked about his support for GMOs, and I think he thinks there's great potential for them, but I can't help but think that Bill Gates probably chooses organic foods whenever he does and GMO-free foods because he has that choice.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, the survey after survey shows over more than a decade basically two things about genetically engineered foods. One is that most Americans don't know that we're already eating them. And two, once they realize that we're already eating them, most Americans, 90% or more in most of the surveys, say that they want these foods labeled so they have a choice of whether or not to eat them. And that's consistent over survey after survey over more than a decade.
Whether or not you believe that GMOs are a salvation for feeding our bulging global population, your issue and your organization, you just want transparency and you want people and consumers to know what they're putting into their bodies, which seems like a pretty non-controversial issue. But why do you have to fight for this?
Well, we shouldn't have to fight for that. But unfortunately, the Food and Drug Administration, as far back as the mid-1980s, sided with the biotech industry in what was really a long-term plan to ensure that Americans never find out that this technology is coming into our food supply. So they came up with an idea that they could simply look at a few components of the foods, the protein levels, the fat levels, and not do any really detailed long-term testing, and just look at those levels and say, well, the GMO soybean looks like a natural soybean. It sounds like a natural soybean. I guess it must be the same as a natural soybean. There is no global agreement on this scientific idea that GMOs are no different than natural foods, which is what the FDA will say and what the biotech industry will say. They've said it over and over again for more than a decade. And yet there is no scientific standard to say, yes, these foods are the same. It's simply something they came up, they made up out of whole cloth, basically as a public relations move, not as a scientific move at all. What scientists do say is that this technology is different than breeding. Even the FDA's own scientists, before the first GMO food was approved, said this technology is different than breeding, it has different risks, and it should be regulated differently. There are dozens of papers from FDA's own scientists online that say that, and yet the agency ignored their scientists and sided with the industry.
Your molecular structure is really something fine. A first-rate example of functional design. Those cosmic undulations are steady coming through. Your molecular structure, baby, me and me. Your cellular organization is really something choice. Electromagnetism about to make me lose my voice. Got all my circuits open, my system's reading gold. Your cellular organization, baby, stop the show.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Charles Margulis. He's a communications director for the Center for Environmental Health. Charles, when did the FDA first approve a GMO food?
Well, the first genetically engineered food on the market, interestingly, was milk from cows that were injected from a genetically engineered drug called bovine growth hormone. And that was approved in the early 90s, in 92 or 93. There was widespread opposition to allowing BGH milk on the market, especially without labeling. Interestingly, what the FDA did was not only did they not require labels on milk from injected cows, but they also tried to prohibit other dairies and companies from labeling that their foods were not from injected cows. So companies like Ben & Jerry's and Stonyfield Farms and lots of small dairies around the country wanted to put no BGH on their labels, and they were sued by the biotech companies. It was only a settlement that allowed these dairies to put that on their labels, and that settlement is still sometimes contested today, where Monsanto, the world's leading maker of genetically engineered foods, still occasionally goes after dairies and other food companies for no BGH labels.
Now, this would be speculation on your part, but let's go back to the FDA's original thought process that went into trying to quote-unquote veil the American consumer from knowing what's going into their food supply. Do you think it was internally they just thought that this was going to be cost prohibitive and too labor intensive for them to try to track this ever-expanding trail of different modified foods or modified ingredients that are going to be going into our food supply? Or do you think there was something a little more devious involved?
Well, we actually don't have to speculate entirely. I mean, the biotech policy was first developed under the Reagan administration, then under the first Bush administration. And when the no labeling policy was released publicly, then Vice President Dan Quayle made the statement on its release, saying this is a welcome regulatory relief for the biotech industry. These were administrations that were hostile to any regulations on any industry, and they saw the biotechnology industry as especially important to the U.S. economy and wanted to have a completely hands-off policy to let the industry basically run amok with our food supply. And unfortunately, that's what's happened.
Do you think that the anti-regulating politicians or the people who espouse a deregulatory environment for pretty much any kind of industry, do you think that the idea of labeling these things to them is a slippery slope?
They will argue that, but what's happened around the world has shown otherwise. So, for example, labeling of GMO foods is required in China, and yet China has a flourishing biotech industry, including making GMO foods. So they're obviously able to both support their scientists in doing this kind of work and allow their consumers to make a free choice. If China can do that, I don't see why we can't do that here.
And getting back to the milk issue, that was a pretty important landmark case, and Monsanto was the, did they develop it, or were they the ones who marketed the bovine growth hormone originally?
Monsanto was one of the developers and original marketers of BGH, along with a couple of other companies.
And how long was BGH in our milk supply without consumers knowing about it?
Unfortunately, BGH is still in the milk supply without consumers knowing it, unless dairy products are labeled no BGH or no RBST, or you may also see no artificial hormones on the labels. Unless you see that, you cannot be sure that the milk from those products did not come from injected cows.
But perhaps these lawsuits with some very well-known brands like Ben & Jerry's not being able to put that something isn't in their products, that could have actually highlighted and educated a populace that didn't know about the possible dangers with BGH before.
That's certainly true. It also unfortunately sets a somewhat risky precedent, putting the onus on producers who are not using a product to label, as opposed to simply requiring labeling when something has changed. I mean, milk was milk for thousands of years. It was a completely natural product. Once that milk was changed, it should have been the onus should have been on the people who changed that product to let consumers know. In other words, labeling should have been required on milk that was from cows that were injected with the drug. With GMO crops, the problem gets even trickier because crops pollinate. Genetically engineered corn growing in the Midwest will contaminate natural corn in neighboring farms for thousands of feet, even farther. So a farmer, even an organic farmer, growing natural corn nearby a genetically engineered corn field, can't be sure that that corn, when it's harvested, is going to test clean if somebody does a GMO test on it. And this has happened. Organic farmers have lost sales because companies are doing testing for GMOs and their corn will turn up positive because neighboring pollen drifted over and contaminated their field.
Let me take you down.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Charles Margulis. He's a communications director for the Center for Environmental Health. Can you tell us about some of the findings with this first generation of young adults who've grown up with GMOs in our food supply? I'm in my 40s, and as a child, I imagine I didn't have genetically modified foods in my diet. But now that we have a little bit of a history of this, have there been any findings or studies that you could point our listeners to?
Well, that's correct. These foods have been in our diets for just a little over a decade. So it's our children who will be the first generation who will be eating these foods for their entire lives. So this is an experiment on them. That's why this is so troubling to so many people, to so many Americans. We don't know the health risks. We don't know what health problems may come up, in part because there is no labeling. So let's take allergies as an example. If you are having allergic problems and a doctor suspects it's from your diet, what the doctor will do is put you on a restrictive diet, and over a period of days they'll restrict different foods to see which foods trigger the allergic reaction. Well, if GMO foods aren't labeled, they may never figure out what's triggering that reaction, because one day you may be restricted from tomatoes and be perfectly fine. The next day you're eating tomatoes, you have an allergic reaction. So the doctor says, oh, well, let's see if it's tomatoes. So they'll check it out, and the next day you'll eat a tomato and you'll be perfectly fine. The doctor will say, well, it can't be tomatoes. Well, there's no way to know that, because one of the tomatoes may have been a GMO tomato and one of them wasn't, and it was the GMO tomato that may have caused the allergy. But the doctor will never be able to figure that out because these foods aren't labeled. So we'll never be able to trace the problems back.
Some of these foods that can trigger anaphylactic reactions, like peanuts, we now see labels that say this product was made in a plant that also handled nuts, or it says, you know, may contain traces of peanuts and other nuts. This was not something that just happened because of the self-interest of agribusinesses being sued over people having allergic reactions to their products. It took vigilance and a lot of campaigning by organizations such as your own, I imagine, to make it happen.
That's right. I mean, any parent dealing with allergies knows how serious an issue it is. Even my kids who don't have allergies go to schools where there are kids who have allergies, and the schools have very restrictive policies about bringing in foods with nuts and other materials. This is an especially serious problem with GMOs because it's been proven in numerous experiments that allergies can transfer unexpectedly when you genetically engineer a crop. Now, the FDA and the industry will say, well, if the genes are from a common allergen like a peanut, we would never do that, and we would never allow that to go on the market without labeling or testing. And that is true. They do require testing for a few of the most common allergens, about six or seven of the most common allergens. Unfortunately, what that doesn't cover is the thousands and thousands of other types of genetic material that they can be using in our food that's never been in our food before, and that may cause allergies that we'd never know about because they've never been in our diets before. And this also isn't just speculation. This is something that happened in a study a couple of years ago where Australian scientists were trying to develop a new kind of pea so their farmers could have a crop that would resist a certain insect that feeds on the peas there. So they used genes from a bean. Now, beans and peas are relatively closely related, so they expected that this would be no problem. But using genetic engineering, this bean gene inserted into the pea created peas that triggered allergies when they did testing in lab animals. And they had to shut down the project. What's interesting is that those kinds of tests are not required for any GMO crops developed in the U.S. And in the most cases, biotech companies don't do those kinds of tests.
In a best-case scenario, Charles, when do you hope to see GMO labels on more products? And what steps need to occur from the FDA standpoint and from the industry standpoint to make it happen?
Well, where we're at right now is Center for Environmental Health and dozens of other organizations have signed on to a petition. This is a legal petition that we sent to the Food and Drug Administration with the lead organizers from the Center for Food Safety about 6 months ago. And that petition lays out the scientific case, the health case, and the public concern about genetically engineered foods, asking the Food and Drug Administration ultimately to require labels on GMO foods. The agency is typically required to respond to that kind of petition within 6 months. The response that was received a couple of weeks ago was, "We're still looking at the petition, we'll get back to you." Unfortunately, that's also very typical. What we hope now is that since more than a million people have signed on to that petition urging the FDA to take that positive action, that that will push the agency to really do something this time. The last time we had this kind of public pressure on the agency in the early 2000s, 2001 and 2002, the agency simply held a series of public hearings around the country. They held three public hearings. I spoke at one of those. It was basically a dog and pony show for the biotech industry to chum up with the FDA and to explain to Americans why we shouldn't worry about these foods and please go away. Well, as you can see, 10 years later, Americans haven't gone away. The a million signatures to the FDA is unprecedented on any kind of issue like this, not just GMOs, but any kind of food labeling issue. And we expect the agency to stand up and pay attention.
I had no milking butter since that cat had been gone. Well, I tried to treat you right day by day. I do a little prayer, boy, get that on your knees and pray, boy, you're gonna need. You're gonna need your loving daddy's help someday.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Charles Margulis. He's a communications director for the Center for Environmental Health. Tell us a little bit about some of the boots on the ground with this campaign. It's much bigger than the Center for Environmental Health, obviously. You're a part of this, but who are some of the leaders in this fight, Charles?
Yeah, I mean, the Center for Food Safety is a lead organization. Food and Water Watch has done great work. The Coalition Center is the Just Label It campaign, and folks can go to justlabelit.org and check out all the other campaign partners. Consumers Union, the publisher of Consumer Reports magazine, has been very active on this, and the Organic Consumers Association, and hundreds of organic groups across the country. And organic consumers and organic growers are especially concerned because genetic engineering is such a threat to the organic food industry. I mean, we're really at the cusp of where we want to go with our food future right now. And there's two paths, really. The biotech and GMO path means going down the same path that the chemical industry has gone down for the last 100 years. I mean, it's important for people to understand the same companies that produce GMO crops are the companies that produced harmful pesticides for the past 50 years. Monsanto, Dow, Syngenta, DuPont. These are all chemical companies who for 50 years have been saying, without our pesticides, we wouldn't be able to feed the world. Our supermarket shelves would be empty. Our pesticides are the most tested chemicals ever in the history of the planet. Now they're saying the exact same thing about their GMO crops, even though the pesticides have failed to show any of the promises that they claim they would. The GMO crops are not going to measure up to those promises either. We have another choice. The choice is organic and sustainable techniques for farming and food production that don't destroy the planet, that produce food that's healthy, and that produce the kind of food that people want to eat.
And one of the claims by the biotech industry is that this is really a game changer for developing nations and small farmers in countries that didn't traditionally have the wherewithal to compete on a global scale with their crops. What's your perspective on that, Charles?
Well, anytime they're threatened, the pesticide industry says the same thing. When Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring, that exposed the hazards of pesticides, they put out a book to counter her called The Desolate Years, which said without pesticides, people in Africa and people in Asia would starve. It's the same old line they trot out every time they're threatened, and it has no backing at all. In fact, GMO crops are made for farmers in the U.S., for first world farmers, so that they can continue to use pesticides. So, for example, the most widely grown GMO crop on the planet is Monsanto's Roundup Ready soybeans. These are soybeans that are engineered to be sprayed with high doses of Monsanto's farm chemical called Roundup. Roundup is an herbicide that basically kills any plant that grows, except it doesn't kill Roundup Ready crops because they're genetically engineered to withstand spraying of this chemical. Now, Monsanto had a patent on Roundup that expired around the year 2000. They started developing their Roundup Ready crops in the early 1990s because they could patent those and sell them along with Roundup to farmers so that they would win two ways. They'd have higher price for their Roundup Ready seed, and they'd continue to be able to sell their Roundup even though they lost the patent on it, and generic versions of it are on sale for cheaper. This is a great strategy for continuing to sell nasty chemicals to spray on risky experimental foods, but it's not going to feed the world.
Charles, what are some of the ways that our listeners could become involved in some of the work that the Center for Environmental Health is engaged in?
Well, in addition to our food work, Center for Environmental Health works on safer electronics. We work on chemical policy reform, and we do product testing. So we were one of the lead groups on testing toys and other children's products for lead that led to the first ever federal law that bans lead in all of children's products. And folks can come to our website, which is ceh.org, or also look on our blog, which is generationgreen.org. And there are lots of ways to get involved.
Charles Margulis from the Center for Environmental Health, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Well, thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by David Grisman, Mose Allison, The Beatles, and Elvis Presley. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Farm Fresh to You Organic Produce Delivery Service, connecting people to farms and leading the progressive change in America's food system. To learn more, go to farmfreshtoyou.com. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.